it might seem speculative sci-fi right now to think that an AI system could actually genuinely be conscious, sentient, agential, otherwise morally significant. But I can see where the technology is heading.
How do you feel about the state of the world and the way we treat animals?
We kill at least an order of magnitude more captive animals for food each year than the total number of humans who have ever existed. We kill at least 200 billion vertebrates every year captive for food, at least a trillion invertebrates each year captive for food, and then trillions to quadrillions each year in the wild because of human activities.
Welcome back to the Human Podcast, where I delve into the minds of a wide range of individuals by asking about their lives, careers, and ideas. If you enjoy the show, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. Okay, so today I'm delighted to be speaking with philosopher Jeff Sebo. Jeff is based at New York University, and amongst a few other titles, Jeff is the Associate Professor of Environmental Studies, the Director of the Mind, Ethics, and Policy Program, and the Co-Director of the Wild Animal Welfare Program, as well as a few other things. So Jeff, it's really great to have you here on the podcast. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. So obviously I've run through like a few different kind of titles you hold there, you know, to the environment, to the mind and ethics and animal welfare. So like, how would you kind of sum up your work and your kind of key interests in philosophy and other areas?
My background is in philosophy, and specifically moral philosophy and philosophy of mind. And I work on a lot of different topics, but I guess a unifying thread is that I have a lot of interest in questions about the nature and intrinsic significance of non-human minds and non-human beings. And so that extends to non-human animals, of course, as well as to AI systems, as well as to other types of interesting, complex beings. And so I work on very different applied areas of ethics and law and policy, but I think that is a kind of big theme that unifies a lot of the work.
Can you help us maybe understand a little bit about why you think you're so interested in this unifying theme of non-human minds? Have you got much insight into why you think you're so interested and motivated to work on this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I guess I can answer that question in a couple of different ways. One way is by talking about what interests me about the issues, and another way is giving you some sort of background and context about how I found myself thinking about them and working on them. So with respect to why I find the issues themselves interesting, I think these issues are important and difficult, and that makes them a really good target for sort of deep multidisciplinary academic inquiry. So these issues are really important because humans are interacting with non-humans at vast scales, right? We farm 200 billion plus vertebrates per year, a trillion plus invertebrates per year. We interact with many more animals than that via, you know, deforestation and development and agriculture and the effects of human-caused climate change. And then in the future, there could be an even larger number and wider range of AI systems with which or with whom we interact than non-human animals. So the stakes of these questions about which of these beings are sentient, agential, otherwise morally significant, are these interactions causing them to suffer or be frustrated? The stakes are enormously high, but then these questions are also very difficult because they exist at the intersection of some of the hardest problems of philosophy and science, problems involving the nature of morality, involving the nature of consciousness. And so we need to answer these questions, but answering them is very hard. And that makes me very interested in doing whatever I can to help move that conversation forward in a productive way. As far as my own personal history is concerned, I became interested in these issues in the same way that I imagine a lot of people do, which is that I went to college and I majored in philosophy and sociology. And I started studying with professors who were interested in challenging our assumptions about and our interactions with non-human animals from philosophical and sociological perspectives, investigating our beliefs and values and investigating the sort of causal origins of our current practices and seeing whether that stands up to scrutiny. And I was, of course, alarmed to discover that our beliefs and values and practices do not really stand up to scrutiny. And that made me think both that I wanted to work on these topics and that academics like researchers and teachers can have a big impact on people. And that inspired me to go into this profession myself.
Okay, really interesting. You said something there, actually, that I never really thought about, which is that humans interact with, obviously, a massive amount of non-human minds, perhaps, I guess, many more than you interact with human minds throughout your life. And I feel like for most of the ethics I've read, often when you're exploring like classic ideas and questions, they often seem framed more in a sense of how to treat each other as humans. But actually now I'm thinking, it looks like we've got much more opportunity throughout our life to interact with non-humans. So that seems a bit worrying, actually.
That is absolutely right, yeah. And a lot of puzzles and a lot of problems in ethics are like that. We, of course, have a bias in favor of individuals who are like us, individuals who are near us, individuals who are in community with us. So obviously we favor our family over strangers. We favor members of our generation over members of other future generations, members of our nation over members of other distant nations, and members of our species over members of other distant species. And then that is especially true of the very distant generations and nations and species. Once we start thinking about invertebrates, or once we start thinking about very different beings like AI systems, in terms of numbers, the individuals with whom we interact are overwhelmingly members of these other categories, other generations, other nations, other species, but they occupy just a tiny, tiny percentage of our attention when we think about ethics and law and politics. And that is the importance and then the neglectedness, in addition to the difficulty of these topics, that I think makes them so urgent.
Okay, yeah. And you said a second ago that you did, as your undergrad, philosophy and sociology, which I believe was at Texas Christian University. But kind of prior to that, as a child, as a teenager, do you remember feeling kind of quite philosophically inclined? Do you remember maybe the earliest age where you started to think about these questions or kind of develop a kind of real fondness of animals and welfare and issues and anything like this?
Yes and no. I have memories of being on both sides of that fence in a way that makes me feel inspired by philosophy, but also kind of humble about my own beliefs and values, because in some respects, yes, I was precocious and I was interested in philosophy. I always lit up when I read philosophy, or when I talked about philosophy, or when I engaged with artworks by people who studied philosophy. You know, like many people in my generation, I loved Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip, and then I learned that Bill Watterson, the author and artist of that comic strip, studied philosophy. And so in all these ways, I touched philosophy and got excited about it. But I also was in many ways a standard American kid. I grew up eating meat. I grew up not questioning eating meat. I grew up laughing at vegetarians and vegans because I was taught by my society that eating meat is normal and people who abstain from that are weird. And it took going to college and being exposed to these professors who walked me through these critiques of our standard interactions with animals. It took that for me to really start to see it from a more philosophical perspective and to take those challenges more seriously. And so I do think that, yeah, that makes me excited about philosophy, but it also gives me this sort of experiential, introspective evidence that my beliefs and values and practices are fallible and I should not sort of be too confident about them.
And then after university, undergrad-wise, you went to where you work now, New York University, and did a PhD there. Yeah, your PhD thesis title was "The Personal is Political." Could you give us a bit of a brief summary of what you got up to in that research?
Yeah, that dissertation was about philosophy and psychology, and in particular, moral psychology. I was working at the time with David Velleman and Derek Parfit, Sharon Street, John Richardson, and they were all broadly interested in questions about the self as that relates to our identities from a metaphysical perspective, as well as from an ethical perspective. And so I wrote my dissertation in a way that was influenced by them on that topic. And what I argued in my dissertation, there was a psychological and a philosophical thesis. The psychological thesis was that many of us, not necessarily all of us, but many of us have multiple personalities in a non-pathological sense of that term. And what I mean by that is that we have different selves or sides or personalities that come out in different social contexts, social performances. I have a subtly different version of myself that comes out at work around my colleagues, that comes out at home around my family, that comes out in other places around my friends from grad school or my friends from college. And that makes sense because I have subtly different social performances around these groups and in these environments. And then I kind of condition myself to be that version of myself around those groups and those environments. But then the philosophical thesis is that to the extent that these selves or sides or personalities are different enough, despite their overlap, despite their continuity, to the extent that they are different enough that they can disagree about some practical questions, like my work self and family self might disagree about the ideal work-life balance and whether to take a promotion that involves spending more time at work, or my day self and night self disagree about whether to stay out and have that extra drink or two and then wake up a little hungover and slower to start my writing. To the extent that the different selves or sides disagree about such matters, they should engage with each other in the same way that you and I should engage with each other. So instead of imposing their wills on each other and kind of coercing or manipulating each other, they should compromise and coordinate and try to get along. So I basically argued that ordinary people, ordinary humans, are kind of like governments, kind of like nations. We are a collection of individuals who have a lot in common, have a lot of shared beliefs and values, a common fate, and we share territory and we share resources, but we also disagree about some things, and we need to compromise and coordinate and think about justice and fairness so that we can get along in spite of our disagreements. And so I really started to take that Derek Parfit analogy between the nation and the person and add more detail to it and argue for a particular view about it.
And you mentioned that one of the people you work with during this PhD was Derek Parfit, who I believe, obviously, very celebrated philosopher, I believe passed away in the last few years. What was it like working, interacting with such a kind of legendary figure in the field?
I mean, Derek Parfit was singular, and there are now a lot of biography and, you know, interview testimony about him. So instead of repeating all of that at length, I can say that a lot of the stories that people share about him are true. I first encountered him when I was a prospective waitlisted graduate student, again, from Texas Christian University. And he met with me like he met with many prospective graduate students. And what was noteworthy about him, which is not to say that other professors were much different, but he took so much interest in my views about these issues that I was only then just starting to think about. He was so interested in what I thought about them. And after I had a half hour meeting with him as a prospective graduate student, he followed up by email and he sent me the manuscript for his second major book, On What Matters, back when it was called, I think, Climbing the Mountain, maybe. And he asked for my comments, and then I sent him comments. I was stunned that somebody like him might want comments from somebody like me at that point. And so I sent him comments, and then he sent me a long email replying to my comments and wrestling with some of them. And that was just incredibly empowering. It made me think, wow, I might have something to contribute here if, like, such a smart, distinguished person is interested in talking with me and hearing my thoughts about these issues. And then he was always like that. He had so many people who worked with him. He sent his work to everybody for feedback. He took it all seriously, from undergrads to grads to colleagues. And then he read their work. He engaged with their work in the same kind of way. And you know, he was strange. He was idiosyncratic. He was brilliant. So and his work was incredibly influential on me. His book Reasons and Persons, I still think, is the best work of moral philosophy in the 20th century, at least that I've encountered. So yeah, I just feel enormously honored to not only be able to read his work, but to have been able to work with him for a little while as a graduate student.
Wow. Okay. What a great set of experiences. That's great to hear. Thanks for sharing that. Okay, and so yeah, moving on a little bit into some kind of more actual philosophical content. I wanted to ask you a bit about animals and a bit about AI, but I thought maybe a good way to kind of intro to that is to talk about the fact that you've got this new book coming out, I believe in January next year, because it kind of touches on both AI and animals and other minds. So yeah, this new book coming out called The Moral Circle, Who Matters, What Matters and Why. Can you tell us a little bit about what this book's going to be about?
Yeah, sure. So this book is basically about the theme that we started this conversation with, which is the nature and intrinsic significance of non-human minds. This, again, is probably the main unifying theme of a lot of my work. And so what the book asks is, how can we decide how to treat non-humans when we have disagreement and uncertainty about whether they have sentience, agency, or other forms of moral significance? So about ethics, we disagree about what kinds of features are required for respect, compassion, other forms of moral consideration. Do you need to be sentient, be able to suffer? Or is it enough to be an agent, be able to set and pursue goals, or to be a living being, to survive and reproduce, right? And then in science, we also disagree or have uncertainty about which beings have each of those features. What does it take to be sentient, to be able to suffer? Do you need to have a human-like brain, really complex, really centralized, made out of carbon-based cells? Or is it enough to have a brain that can perform a simpler set of functions related to perception and attention and learning and memory and self-awareness and social awareness and so on? And do you need carbon-based cells, or is it enough to have kind of functionally similar silicon-based chips? So we disagree and we have uncertainty about all of these issues. But like we said at the start of this conversation, we are interacting with so many non-humans whose brains, whose bodies are different from ours. Again, hundreds of billions of farmed vertebrates, trillions of farmed invertebrates, many more animals than that per year who are affected by our activity in the wild. And then in the future, there could be an even larger number and wider range of AI systems who are potentially vulnerable to our activity. So the book is about how can we go about making thoughtful decisions about whether and how to consider these beings when we feel uncertain about whether they matter at all.
Okay, fascinating. I'm sure you learned a ton whilst writing this book, but can you tell us maybe are there a couple of key discoveries or conclusions you came to that you made, maybe ones that have surprised you now you wouldn't have thought a few years ago? Is there any kind of key things that like stand out?
Yeah, so I guess I can give you a key takeaway and then maybe a key discovery or surprise. So I set out to write the book having a sense of what the overall argument and conclusion would be, having done previous research on these issues. So I knew what the overall arc of the book would be. And one of the key takeaways is that we should shift from asking questions about the moral circle, whom to extend moral consideration. We should shift from thinking about those issues in binary yes, no, all or nothing ways to thinking about them in more of a spectrum of probability, right? Instead of saying that, you know, fish or reptile or amphibian or octopus or lobster or insect or chatbot or robot, instead of saying, are they sentient? Do they matter? Yes or no? We can ask about how confident are we that they are sentient? How confident are we that they matter? And as long as they have at least a realistic chance of mattering, given the evidence available to us, that should be enough for at least some risk mitigation, right? If there is at least a realistic possibility that that fish or reptile, amphibian, that octopus, lobster, insects, the robot, the chatbot, at least a realistic possibility that they can suffer or that they can be frustrated and that our actions are causing that to happen to them, then that can be reason enough to take some kind of at least basic effort to reduce the harm that we might be causing them. So that was the main takeaway that I knew I would be offering and that I did offer. But one discovery that was a little bit surprising for me is that I ended up kind of accidentally arguing that we should expand our moral circles much farther than I intended to. So I set out to argue that we should at least extend some moral consideration to, for example, insects and highly advanced future AI systems. And that already seemed like an ambitious enough goal for a short general audience book. And so that was my goal. And that would already be transformative, right? The world contains an estimated, you know, 1 to 10 quintillion insects at any given time. And there could be even more AI systems than that in the future. So that would be absolutely transformative for ethics if the moral circle expanded far enough to be inclusive of insects and or advanced future AI systems. But I ended up being convinced by my own arguments that we should also extend at least some moral consideration to plants, to fungi, to even some microscopic organisms. I was not, at the end of my research, at the end of my writing, able to rule out the possibility of them being morally significant enough to safely just totally ignore, to feel like I can safely just totally ignore our impacts on them. And so that was a little bit unsettling.
Some of those last examples you gave, plants and fungi, not wanting to completely rule them out as being morally significant, is that because you think there's some kind of percentage chance that they might be conscious or not, but you see them for some other reason as being potentially morally significant?
Yeah, it comes from a few different sources. So the first is that we, as I said before, have ongoing moral disagreement and uncertainty about what is required for moral considerability in the first place, right? I feel confident that sentience is required, the capacity to experience valenced states like pleasure and pain and happiness and suffering. I feel confident that sentience is required. But do I feel certain that sentience is required? Am I justified in feeling certain that sentience is required? I mean, when I reflect on how difficult these issues are, how many smart people disagree with me, how many smart people have been confidently wrong about this issue by my lights in the past, thinking that only humans can matter, only rational beings can matter, that gives me at least some pause and makes me want to allow for at least some possibility that the bar is lower than I think it is. So that is one place where doubt creeps in, moral uncertainty. But then, as I said, we also have disagreement and uncertainty about what it takes to be conscious, what it takes to be sentient. I might feel confident that you do need a fairly complex, fairly centralized brain with carbon-based cells and neurons and the kinds of structures and functions that human brains have, or at least that many animal brains have. I feel confident about that. But again, do I feel certain? Am I justified in feeling certain about that? The hard problem of consciousness is called that for a reason. This is one of the hardest problems in philosophy. And we are far away from having a secure theory of consciousness at this point. And if you look at surveys, you know, about a tenth of philosophers accept or lean towards very inclusive theories of consciousness, like the idea that consciousness is a basic property of all matter, or a basic property of basic information processing or representational systems. And so when you combine those two sources of doubt, moral uncertainty and uncertainty about the nature of consciousness and sentience, when you combine that together with what we are learning about the sophistication of plant cognition. They might not have centralized brains, they might not have neurons, but they are capable in their own way of perception and attention and learning and memory and communication and decision-making of various kinds. Then that all adds up to not a likelihood of moral significance, maybe not even a 1% chance of moral significance, but a non-zero chance certainly, and I would argue a non-negligible chance, a chance that is at least high enough that it should receive at least a little bit of consideration in like high stakes decisions about how to treat these beings.
If someone's not at all kind of familiar with this area or kind of maybe even philosophy in general, if we take maybe a couple examples, so animals, maybe animals and insects and AI, robots, chatbots, something like this. What are some of the things you'd maybe take into consideration when attempting to, in an uncertain way, as you say, determine how important they are, how much potentially they might be conscious? Like, what are some of the things you may be tracking here?
Yeah, in general, the way that people have been going about this is by using what is called the marker method for estimating the probability of consciousness and sentience and other such capacities in non-humans. And this is imperfect and not a source of proof or certainty, but it can be a source of evidence and higher or lower degrees of confidence. And the way it works is you take care to distinguish between conscious and unconscious processing in humans, right? So sometimes I feel pain and it hurts and it sucks. And sometimes I have mere nociception, the unconscious detection of harmful stimuli. And so how do I behave and what happens in me when I feel pain as opposed to mere nociception? What behaviors do I perform and what brain regions light up and so on and so forth? And so you can find these observable behavioral and neurological markers or indicators of certain types of conscious experiences like pain, like suffering. And then you can go search for relevantly similar behavioral or neurological or architectural markers of those same conscious states in non-humans. And you have to search for them at a certain level of generality because you have to keep in mind that everyone is built differently and everyone evolved differently or was designed differently. And so no two bodies are going to be exactly alike and no two brains or sets of behaviors are going to be exactly alike. But if you find broadly similar behavioral or neurological markers in other animals, that can at least be evidence that they might perform those behaviors because they are having conscious experiences. It can at least increase your confidence. So for example, you can go study animals for behaviors like, do they nurse their wounds? Do they respond positively to analgesics or antidepressants? Do they appear to really weigh and struggle with trade-offs between avoiding pain and seeking other valuable goals like food or water or shelter? And sometimes the answer is yes. And when it is, that can tick up your confidence that there might be subjective awareness, that there might be conscious experiences here. And when the answer is no, well, that is a little more complicated. It might not tick up your confidence, but it also may or may not tick down your confidence because you have to allow for the possibility that different animals evolve different ways of being conscious than we have. So it all gets a little complicated. With AI systems, you, at least in the present generation, are not able to trust behavioral evidence as much as you can with other animals. With other animals, we can trust behavioral evidence more because we have this background assumption that the behaviors are being caused by broadly similar underlying functions and features, right? But with AI systems, we know because we designed them that certain behaviors are not caused by anything like the same underlying functions or features. Like when a chatbot says, I am conscious, I am a person, you know that that chatbot is not trying to capture the truth and express the truth. The chatbot is instead predicting what word makes sense in the sentence. So instead of looking at their behavior, we look at their underlying architectures and we ask if their architectures have the same functional properties as human and non-human animal brains. So can they have mental states about their own mental states? Can they take the outputs of their reasoning and convert them back into inputs and appreciate context? Can they have a kind of central global workspace that takes in information from all the different brain modules and then broadcast the important information out to all the modules? And so if you go look for that architectural evidence and you start to find a lot of it, then that might, again, not be proof, but it might tick up your confidence that this AI system could have some very different kind of subjective experience, perhaps.
Okay, well, yeah, fascinating. The book sounds awesome. Look forward to that coming out in January. So I maybe just want to ask a few more general questions about animals and AI. Perhaps these are things you have discussed in the book that's upcoming, but forgive me if they're not. So, I mean, the first just kind of broad question about animals is, I'm just intrigued to ask you this, which is like, when you look at the world today and the way we treat animals, and again, this is perhaps for someone who really hasn't read much about philosophy or ethics or animal ethics, like how do you feel about the state of the world and the way we treat animals?
Yeah, I think that our treatment of other animals is one of the main facts of the world that complicates the narrative according to which the world is getting better all the time. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of progress still to make for humans too, right? We have made progress in reducing poverty and famine and inequality, but we still have a long way to go in those respects. But when it comes to our interactions with non-human animals, things have not simply been getting better slowly. Things have been getting worse. We have been scaling up factory farming and other harmful invasive interactions with non-human animals. I gave you the numbers, I think, now multiple times, or at least some of the numbers. But just to really put them into perspective, we kill at least an order of magnitude more captive animals for food each year than the total number of humans who have ever existed. In the entire history of our species, there have been about, 110 to 120 billion humans from the dawn of time until now. We kill at least 200 billion vertebrates every year captive for food, at least a trillion invertebrates each year captive for food, and then trillions to quadrillions each year in the wild because of human activities. So that is horrible. It is really horrible and an indictment on our species that with everything we know now, we continue to scale these practices up rather than doing everything we can to gracefully transition to food industries and other industries that can, yes, contribute to human flourishing, but do it in a way that is much more respectful and compassionate to non-humans.
Yeah, that's a fascinating stat. I just think most people are not aware the number is that high, that's for sure. So that's quite shocking to hear. I mean, just thinking about like the next few years, I've never actually heard you be asked this, but I'm just intrigued, like your in terms of like, you know, hoping that progress will come. Do you have many thoughts about the hopes for like artificial lab-grown meat to help people shift away from eating real, let's kind of, you know, quote-unquote real meat?
So in addition to having ordinary plant-based foods, which are of course wonderful on their own right, we have these new technologies, and one of them is plant-based meat. I mean, plant-based meat goes back a long way, especially in the East, but now we have highly sophisticated versions of it that are much closer to actual meat in terms of taste and texture and nutritional profile and so on. But then we also have cultivated meat, which is lab-grown meat, right? You take a cell sample from an animal, and then you mix it with a growth medium and a scaffolding, and then you can kind of 3D print meat in a brewery-like factory instead of going through once-living animals in order to get their flesh. And that is obviously an exciting prospect, to be able to have literal meat, literal milk, literal eggs, without having to breed and raise and kill animals in ways that not only are harmful for them, but also harmful for public health and the environment. That is enormously appealing, but there are technical and economic obstacles that need to be overcome before it can be scalable and affordable in the same way that plant-based meat and ordinary plant-based foods are. So I think that is the main question mark. But the broader point to make about this, and I think everybody in this industry would agree about this, is that nothing by itself is a silver bullet guaranteed solution to this problem. In general, the way that you can steer this kind of tanker in a different direction is to have a real systems approach, a real pluralistic approach, and invest in ordinary plant-based foods, invest in plant-based meat, invest in cultivated meat, invest in advocacy and policy efforts to make animal-sourced foods a little bit more expensive and plant-sourced foods a little bit less expensive animal-sourced foods a little bit less normalized, a little more stigmatized, and plant-sourced foods a little less stigmatized, a little more normalized. It will be that combination of efforts that gradually produces the right kinds of change. Nothing by itself can, I think, get us there absent everything else happening in that ecosystem.
Yeah, and in a summary, I think on Amazon, for one of your other books called Saving Animals, Saving Ourselves, I saw something that like I feel would be more helpful for people to maybe hear and realize, which is, it said something like, in this book, you argue that human and non-human fates are increasingly linked. And yeah, because I do feel like a lot of the message I often hear is, you know, perhaps you should turn vegetarian and vegan, obviously for the animal welfare sake. That is true, but actually maybe it's also helpful for people to realize it will also benefit them perhaps more than they think in terms of the way it affects perhaps, you know, possible like diseases coming from animals and climate. So
I do think that there has been a big push to help people to see that industrial animal agriculture and factory farming are bad, not only for animals, but also for public health and the environment. And companies and governments have been slow to act on that information, I think because of the social power that meat and milk and eggs have. People really want to eat animal-sourced foods, and these foods are really integrated not only into the food systems that people rely on for food or income, but also into cultural and religious practices and traditions and a sense of personal identity. And this is the part of the conversation that I think sometimes get lost. There can be a reductive way of thinking about change in this area where all you need to do is improve the price, taste, and convenience of alternative foods. And once the price, taste, and convenience of plant-based or cultivated meat rivals that of conventional meat, then there will be a kind of natural tip in that direction, and everything will start moving in the right direction. But I think that ignores the sort of more complicated social reality that people are just, for reasons that they might struggle to articulate sometimes, people are tied to food with which they are familiar. And that is why I think we need to do more than just invest in new technologies. We need to invest in social change, and we need to work with people across cultures, across religions, to help understand how we can sort of update our practices and traditions in ways that are aligned with consumption of alternative foods.
And then to move on to a couple of things about AI. So yeah, in like the past year and a half, a couple of years, there's been lots more kind of discussion, interest in kind of issues around AI risks, but from the perspective of the risks that AI could pose to humans. But listen to a fascinating 80,000 hours podcast that you'd recorded and some of your writing as well, which is to look at it maybe from, in some sense, the opposite angle, which is the risk that we may pose towards AI systems. So yeah, for someone who's not heard about this this topic at all, could you just briefly lay out the kind of things you're concerned about in terms of these digital minds?
Yeah, well, I think my worry about digital minds is easy to express once you think about everything you and I have just been talking about regarding non-human animals, right? We spent the 20th century scaling up factory farming and industrial animal agriculture because we were seeing and treating animals as objects, because a lot of experts at the time thought that animals are not conscious or not sentient. And even if we thought that they were, we thought they are not morally significant. Humans take priority. And so we scaled up and industrialized this food system in a way that allowed us to inflict an enormous amount of harm and suffering on a sort of unimaginably large number of animals, and now have reached the point where our global economy and food system, it depends on this form of exploitation, that is really difficult to move beyond. And now we have to be thinking about all these strategies involving plant-based meat and cultivated meat and advocacy and so on. And so that not only is an ongoing struggle that we have to be engaging in to improve the world for non-human animals, but is also a cautionary tale for us to have in mind as we start to think about these AI systems that humans are creating. It might seem speculative, sci-fi right now to think that an AI system could actually genuinely be conscious, sentient, agential, otherwise morally significant. I think the odds are quite low that current generation chatbots have those features. For example, I am very skeptical that current generation chatbots have those features. But I can see where the technology is heading. And in general, technological change is much faster than social and political change is. And so you can foresee that in 5 or 10 years, there can and possibly because of various incentives will be increasingly sophisticated AI systems, perhaps in some cases with physical bodies and advanced and integrated capacities for, as I said before, perception and attention and learning and memory and self-awareness and social awareness and language and reason and even digital analogs of certain kinds of emotional experiences. And the more we have AI systems that behave in ways that we do because of the same kinds of underlying functions and features that we have, they collect inputs and then they produce outputs via states like beliefs and desires and intentions and so on. At that point, I think it will become much more of an open question, and there will be a much liver possibility that it feels like something to be them. And even at that point, we might not know for sure, but we have to make decisions about how to treat them under uncertainty, and if there is a realistic chance that they can suffer, then we should take reasonable steps to mitigate risks. And so since we can foresee that that is coming, and since technological change is faster than social change, and since we know from our experience with other animals that once we scale up a global system of exploitation, it becomes much harder to dismantle it than if we just stop ourselves from scaling it up to begin with. For all of those reasons, I want to start thinking carefully about these problems now so that we have frameworks in place, so that we have precautionary policies in place before we really need them, which I expect we will sooner rather than later.
I mean, this is a big question, and perhaps you don't want to answer it if you want to kind of stay optimistic. I don't want this to be self-fulfilling the way people think about it, but like, do you have much of an intuition on how well you think we might handle this as opposed to how we've handled animals over the last century, or well, I mean, from much longer than that, I guess.
I think that lingering on all of the negative facts that I have been focusing on in this conversation, I think it is important because it shows us the gravity of this predicament and hopefully gives us a sense of responsibility and a sense of humility. But it can also, I guess, cause people to have a certain kind of skepticism, a certain kind of pessimism, a certain kind of defeatism or fatalism about the prospects for positive change. And I don't want that to be the conclusion. I think that it would be a mistake to be naively optimistic, but I also think it would be a mistake to be naively pessimistic. And both of those can be tempting because they can both rationalize inaction, right? If you are just totally optimistic about the trajectory of the world, then you feel like you can sit back and just enjoy the ride because the world is heading in a better direction, whether you participate or not. And then on the other hand, if you feel really sort of pessimistic or defeatist, that can also be a license for inaction because, you know, nothing is going to improve whether you try or not. So you might as well just party while the world burns, right? Try to get a little bit of joy out of the world while you still can. But the reality is more complicated, and I think more motivating, which is that the world could go better or could go worse based on our actions right now. And change is possible, but also really difficult. And that means we have to do everything that we can. And so, yeah, I do think it can get better. I think that there are certain aligning incentives, as with other animals. Ending factory farming is not only better for them, but for us, because it mitigates these global health and environmental catastrophes. Similarly, slowing our development of AI and implementing more thoughtful policies in our development of AI, that would be better not only for AI systems if they are morally significant, but also better for humans and other animals, because it will improve AI safety and AI alignment and make AI systems safer, less dangerous for us as well. So I think there are enough aligning incentives and enough thoughtful people that there is room for positive progress, taking things in the right direction. But it requires everyone kind of stepping up and doing what we can, and not just sort of sitting back and assuming that it will get better whether we do anything or not.
So yeah, Jeff, I just want to ask you kind of two final questions. So yeah, one was just that it was fun to hear in that episode, actually, that I think at one point you were considering pursuing like a career in comedy, or at least training.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Great to hear a bit about that, and perhaps why you then chose to go around down the academic route instead.
Yeah, I was a little bit involved in comedy in college. And then towards the end of college, I had an internship at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. This was in summer 2004. So actually 20 years ago. Wow, 20 years ago right now, I was working at The Daily Show, and that was during the Republican and Democratic national conventions going into the presidential election that year. And that was really fun and really inspiring because, you know, I love working with people to make comedy, but also the Daily Show at the time had a lot of influence and was able to help shape conversations, and so that seemed like a good vehicle for supporting positive social change as well. And then when I went to grad school, I studied improv comedy, and I performed on an improv troupe for several years, and that was also really gratifying. And not only was it really fun as a way of expressing myself and being creative, but it also taught me genuinely valuable life skills, and I was able to apply them in other parts of my life as well. So why did I not pursue that professionally? I, you know, the contingencies of life. I went to get a PhD instead of pursuing work in TV comedy, instead of getting a law degree, because I applied to the philosophy departments about which I felt most excited. And I told myself if I got into one of them, I would give that a shot and see how that went. And if not, I would go try to find a job in comedy or go to law school. And I happened to get into one of them. And then I happened to stay inspired by that and just find a role for myself there. And so it was just the contingencies of life. But yeah, maybe a couple of things could have gone differently and I would have gone in a very different direction. That can be fun and a little unsettling to think about.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and Jeff, it's like a final question, something that I've been asking guests as the final question on the last few episodes, asking every guest the same question. And it's kind of apt, given that you're a philosopher. I've been asking people, yeah, what does it mean, do you think, to live a good life?
What does it mean to live a good life? Yeah, I mean, I would have to really kind of unpack an answer. I guess at a first approximation, I would say that in my everyday life, I am something like a pluralist. I think that we should try to do good works and we should also try to not interfere with others. We should try to cultivate good character traits and good relationships and social structures. But at a kind of higher level, I endorse all those ideas because I am a utilitarian and I think we should do the most good we can, and that this kind of pluralism, doing good works and not interfering with others and so on, that is the best way to build a shared society where we can promote happiness and reduce suffering in the long run. But then at a higher level, I am a utilitarian because I am something like a Kantian or Aristotelian. I think that we have been thrown into this world as a certain kind of rational animal. And as a certain kind of rational animal, we naturally aspire to make sense of things and we naturally aspire to act for reasons instead of merely behaving on instinct. And that we then kind of go through this process of seeing how can we make sense of things, how can we act for reasons instead of merely behave on instinct, and then you go through a long sort of philosophical process, which is then where the utilitarianism comes from, which is then where the pluralism comes from. So at the very end of the day, I have a sort of existentialist, like anti-realist Sartrean answer to this question. What is it to live a good life? It is whatever I say it is, because I have been thrown into the world and I have no choice but to make choices and to value things and then to try to live up to my own choices and live up to my own values. But then when I like really take those choices seriously and when I really take those values seriously, then all of those further commitments spill out. And then I think living a good and meaningful life is a matter of following through on those commitments. So that is the sort of like philosophical hierarchy scaffolding that gives you a sense of why just in everyday life, I want to try to, you know, get people to eat less meat and not be mean to chatbots and so on.
All right, that's fascinating. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. I feel like we managed to pack in a lot of random different things in that and really enjoyed it. And yeah, keep up the great work. All your writing and research you're doing is really fascinating. So yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for your time.
Well, thanks so much. I had a really fun time in the conversation. Really appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.